Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks so much for coming out and Sylvia speak. My name is Alex Knight. I was part of a study group that read Sylvia's book, Caliban and the Witch, last year. And it blew my mind so much that we had to get Sylvia to come speak. But I was going to tell you a little bit about who Sylvia is. She was born in Italy during World War II. In the 70s, she was involved in the women's movement, and specifically got involved in the Wages for Housework campaign, which was an effort to recognize and value the unpaid labor that women were doing to sustain the economy, and was involved in the United States and New York, and even came to Philadelphia for it. Later on in the 80s, she went and lived in Nigeria and witnessed firsthand the structural adjustment neoliberal policies that were being implemented by the World Bank and IMF, which had the effect of really attacking students and really just the whole population, making it very precarious, and then came back and was involved in the Committee for Academic Freedom in Africa. More recently, she was also involved with the Midnight Notes Collective, which has done a lot of theoretical work about capitalism from a sort of autonomous Marxist perspective. And then she wrote the book Caliban and the Witch, or finished writing the book Caliban and the Witch, which for me was just a mind-blowing experience to read. And I just had the experience of when I learned about the witch hunts and learned about the connection with capitalism, and I just felt like I understood capitalism, our society, in a whole different way that I had never imagined before, in terms of violence against women, in terms of all the unpaid labor that people are doing to sustain the system, and 500 years of anti-capitalist resistance. Just absolutely a mind-blowing experience. This is why we organized a study group. And I wanted to say something last night but forgot. But for those of you who got the book last night, or those of you who are interested in getting and reading the book, I encourage you to do it as part of a group, because I think you get a lot more out of it. You have a way of, when you're reading something that you're going to discuss in a group, you read it a little bit differently. You maybe get a little bit more out of it. So as an idea, it really worked for us. So it may be good if other folks organize things similar. But without further ado, Sylvia can tell you the rest. So here's Sylvia Federici.
I think I'll start first liberating myself from all this, because it's much warmer than I expected. Okay. Well, what I'm going to do tonight is to share with you some very informal thoughts about experiences that I have made in the course of my political organizing in the feminist movement and after, and also thoughts that have come as a result of discussion I've had in more recent years with younger people on the question of political work, on the question of how we can do political work, engage in processes of struggle without destroying ourselves, and how to create what we came to define as self-reproducing movements, you know, movements that can sustain themselves, that do not, you know, surge and disappear, but in a way can sustain themselves, grow, expand, and, as I said before, not expand at the cost of the lives of those who participate in them. What I'm presenting is not, you know, anything systematic. It's the product of a number of reflections that I've also developed in the course of the theoretical work I've done, especially for the book Caliban and the Witch that I wrote. I'll start by saying that if I guess the thesis I want to present tonight, right, is that we cannot liberate ourselves unless we change the world. Right? It's a very simple thesis that I'm sure all of you already have adopted, that is impossible to have individual processes of liberation. That in a sense, the kind of healing, the kind of reconstruction of our life that we need to do, that motivate us to engage in broader processes of struggle, right, cannot in a sense succeed unless we change the world around us. And by the same token, we cannot change the world unless we do engage in the process of self-transformation. And these are the themes to which I want to talk, at least bring some historical experience, bring some reflection that maybe can be useful to you, as in some ways it has been useful, you know, to me, to my political work. One of the experiences and the realizations that has helped me most in putting this question in perspective, it's been the realization that capitalism has not asserted its hegemony, has not developed, expanded, and imposed its rules on our lives simply by, you know, general economic restructuring, or by military power, by repression, but it has done so by, in a way, disempowering us, by destroying many of the powers that, you know, historically, because of our historical development, and because of the struggles that we have engaged in, and because of our place in the natural world, which I'll talk about in a minute, we have developed. In other words, that I think is very, very important, or at least has been important in my work, to realize that far from expanding our powers collectively and individually, capitalism has asserted its hegemony by a massive process of disempowerment. And it's a process that has many sides, you know, that has many components, and that we need, I think, to keep in mind if we start thinking of how we reconnect what capitalism has separated in our life, and how we reclaim, or if not reclaim, what was lost, because there is never going back to the past, but at least how we can, you know, relaunch our life in a very different way. One of the most important form of disempowerment that, you know, historically has defined, you know, who we are, our subjectivity in a capitalist environment, has been the long process of separation of our life from the natural world. This is a theme that today it's very, very topical, right? The destruction of the environment around us and our separation from nature, you know, except in a sense as tourists in nature. It's a theme that is daily under our eyes. But I want to go a little bit deeper into this question. You know, in Caliban and the Witch, there is one chapter in which I discuss about the transformation that the bodies underwent in the process of capitalist development. You know, what it took to form an individual what it took to form a worker, right, that could be the accepting of the capitalist discipline of labor. And I analyzed different processes, different disciplinary regime, different disciplinary processes that were, in a sense, applied, right, to the population of 16th, 17th century Europe, as well as the population of the, you know, colonial world that was conquered. And one thing that became very, very clear is that capitalism, like no other system before, right, has in a way denaturalized the body, denaturalized the you know, subjectivity and the body of the people it has subjugated. And I'm using denaturalized in quote, right? In the sense that for the capitalist discipline of work to prevail, you know, a whole attack on very deep-seated resistances, you know, had to be launched. Resistances that I came to understand, you know, has been the product of a long process of accumulation, deriving from the fact that we, as human beings, you know, have grown, have formed who we are through thousands and thousands of years of, you know, intimate interaction with the natural world. You know, I would speak of coevolution, right? In other words, you know, our bodies have been very strictly, you know, shaped by the interaction with nature. And that, and this interaction through our work and to being part of the natural environment. And this interaction has created a vast range of knowledges, a vast range of resistances, needs, desires that capitalism has opposed, frustrated, attacked more, I believe, than any other system. Because capitalism is a system of exploitation and accumulation that you know, depends on the intensive exploitation of labor. And so the kind of discipline that it has imposed on workers and the human body has been, in a way, far more intense, far more severe than the one the other systems have applied to us. For instance, you know, I realize how important it is for our well-being and the fact that we need to see the sky. I mean, you know, our life was shaped by the interaction with the winds, with the sounds of the waters, the sight of the seas. It's very important for us to be able to see the light of the sun, you know, to see again the seas, the contact with the land, you know. Generation, thousands and thousands of generations of farmers have grown and in that intimate interaction with the natural world, right? And their bodies have been shaped in a very powerful way by that. And not only farmers, fishermen, navigators. You know, there's a story I like to share, which is for, I don't know if you have read this book by Connell called The People's History of Science, right? That tells you that thousands of years ago, perhaps 4,000 of years ago, people in the Pacific Island, in Polynesia, used to be able to navigate the sea. Right? At night, even in nights when there were no stars and no moon, because their bodies were so attuned to the surge of the sea, to the surge of the waves, that they could tell just by lying on the bottom of their boats. They could tell whether the waves, they were taking them towards the land or were taking them away from the land. So this gives us some insight. You know, when we speak of knowledge, we are very proud of how our computers now are expanding our knowledge. These were fishermen, people who could actually go home and find the right way home, right, by listening to. That's how sensitive their body had become in the constant interaction with the sea. But beside knowledges, of course, that interaction also created resistances, resistances that capitalism has historically tried to break, right? For example, by lengthening the workday, you know, beyond the light of the sun, forcing people to work with electrical light, or forcing people to work through the night, or breaking the connection between work and the rhythm of the season, right? Reaching the extreme of today, when you know, we have millions of people in our urban centers who spend months and months and months of daily work without ever seeing the sky, right? Basically working in an environment where they have no light, no window, no sight of the sun, no sight of the sky. Even just that, you know, even the realization of this daily reality, which is now, it's normal. There is no class struggle around it. There is no union movement who is fighting, you know, against the fact that this slow torture, when you realize, in fact, you know, what the history of our body has been, and what our needs, very deep needs, this history has created, you realize that this is a kind of a daily torture that is part of a whole sea of unhappiness, of a whole sea of frustration, of unsettlement that we are not even any longer aware of. You know, so much it is assumed to be the inevitable part of our everyday existence. So on that kind of reflection, right, that kind of realization of what the separation, and this is obviously what I've given here, is only a minuscule part, a very minuscule part of what has happened to us, right, in the kind of separation that we have suffered from the natural world, right? But this is certainly something that we need to reflect and explore in an even deeper level in our political work. Because, for example, when we place the question of the seas and the question of the land, which fortunately are coming to the center of our political organizing also here, they are not any longer issues that are seen as belonging to the third world, right? Those questions are not only economical questions. Question of food and survival, which is extremely important, you know. But there are also questions of, you know, regaining a certain harmony, regaining a certain interaction with the world of nature. That it's very important for our emotional, psychological well-being, integrity. Similarly, you know, capitalism has attacked not only our relationship with the natural world, but also our relationship with other people. You know, and here there is a vast world of experiences and histories that I think we need to pay attention to in their implications. Because, you know, it's common knowledge that the rise of capitalism has produced, right, an individualizing experience. What we need to explore more is all the different ways, you know, in which a conception of the body and an experience of the body that was very expansive, right? Think of the Middle Age or the Renaissance, where the body was seen as you know, a microcosm, a small world, but connected with the universe, responding to all kinds of influences, you know, coming from you know, the broader you know, natural world around. And think also about the pre-capitalist society, in which most activities were collective activities. Most work activities were done with other people. I've written in the Caliban about you know, women in the Middle Ages. The fact that whether you washed your sheets or procreated, you were always part of a communal world. You were always surrounded by other women. You were never engaged in this activity as an isolated individual. And that activity was not only a work activity, it was also part of a broader sociality. So that, for example, the room in which women procreated was a room full of women, each providing some form of support to the one who was supposed to deliver the child. And similarly, washing, cleaning, these were very much farming, right? We speak today of the commons, of communalism. And again, there is no returning to the past, and there is no idealizing of the past, because in many cases, those communal structures were not necessarily egalitarian structures, but certainly tell us of a different way of organizing life, of a different way of conceiving sociality, in which social life and work, in which production and reproduction were not yet separated. You know, we, particularly in the United States, you know, have gone through such a radical process, right, of desocialization, that again, we are only beginning to recognize that it's going to be a long way to reclaim the type of collectivity and sociality that, you know, it's possible and that we need in order to construct a different society, right? I'm not to tell you, because you know this history probably better than me, you know, the history of what was done in Second World War, after the Second World War, with the construction of Levittown, right? But very clearly, for a long time, the principle of capitalist development, the principle of capitalist society, has been that the only place, the only way in which people can come together as a collectivity, right, is in the workplace. You know, it's in the place in which they are most subjective under, you know, the control of the employer, under capital control, under specific rules applying to the organization of work. Whereas, you know, in the process of reproduction, the principle has been that the rule has been individualization of reproduction, atomization of reproduction, and this has been the principle of urban plans like Levittown, like the construction of suburbia, that had a very, very specific, you know, goal in mind, right, of isolating people, ensuring that the kind of organizing, the kind of socializing that would issue, you know, from the industrial workplace, you know, would be broken down at the point of reproduction, right? So that actually everything was studied in a very minute way, so that, you know, how people lived, how their space and work was organized in the home, right, would prevent, you know, any possibility of aggregation, right? And there are very interesting studies that you may know on this subject. For example, Dolores Hayden, American by Design. I don't know if you have read that book. That's a book I would highly recommend, because it clarifies a lot of issues that sometimes are very confused. You know, for instance, why capitalism has not industrialized the home, right? Why they have not applied the same principle of industrial efficiency to the area of reproduction, to the home, to housework, to domestic work, right? Why you have all these separate families, separate houses, separate units, which from a standard capitalist viewpoint would appear highly inefficient. But in reality, when you see what has been the logic that has inspired urban planning at different stages in the United States, for instance, you know, which has been a very advanced country in these matters, you realize that there was another efficiency, and the efficiency had to do with the need of keeping people separate from each other, with the need to break down certain ties that may originate from the kind of solidarity and from the kind of struggle and resistances connected with the process of work, with the resistances to exploitation, you know, in the waged workplace, right? So that, you know, at the end of the work, you had to be dispersed, you had to be disaggregated to basically preempt the possibility of revolts, the possibility of a difference. And I'm using this as one example, but the example of the separation from others is vast. You know, most of the important experiences in our life are experiences that now we have that we confront alone, right? Disease, death, not only birth, right? Birth, death, disease, some of the most fundamental, those situations in which we would need most intensely, right? To feel the connection with other people are in fact those that we confront in a way most alone. One example, and I could make many others, but the relationship to death. You know, interestingly, there's been in the last few years many groups, at least in New York, of younger people who have begun to come together and speak of communities of care. How do we build communities of care? And one of the reasons why they decided to do that, and there's been a number of zines that have been produced, has been precisely out of this realization that in moment of intense trauma, moment of intense pain, moment of death, loss, they found themselves alone, even when they would be engaged in a movement, even when they were part of a movement. And, you know, I want to make the example of death tonight to say that something so important that for centuries, a death, even among very poor people, was considered something collective, a collective loss, you know, for whom the bell tolls, right? In other words, when you heard the bells, a person died, and the bells were, you know, telling everybody in the community that somebody had died, that there had been a loss, and everybody was expected to know. Right? And if you look internationally, it's interesting to see the kind of rituals that human beings devised in the past to mark the passing of a person, right? Rituals, they had a double component. You know, one component was to establish that the death of a person is something that, again, is not an individual loss. Is something that affects a whole community. So that, for example, in Europe, funerals would pass through the streets of a town. Everybody had to see the funeral, and everybody had to stop when the funeral passed. Right? In many cases, in the 19th century, and even into the 20th, you know, in a building, the whole building would be told that somebody had died, and signs would be posted so that everybody would become aware of their loss, right? And the other part of this ritual, of course, was to, you know, reconnect people, was to mitigate, right, the pain and the loss of those who remain by, you know, reaffirming the continuity of life, by reaffirming the solidarity of the community in this moment of loss, right? Death is disappearing from our lives. You know, death is becoming more and more and more a phenomenon that is so extremely individualized that many people that basically come to conclusion that they are even ashamed of showing their pain. That not only they are facing death now, the loss of the people they care for most alone, but they are even made to feel guilty if they miss too many days of work, or if they display an excessive pain on their job or in the situation in which they are supposed to be active, right? So that pain has become a source of shame. Mm-hmm. Despair and confrontation with loss. So these to me are very key example of the progressive process of desocialization, right? In which, in a way, our sense of ourselves as part of a collective body, which is a great power when you feel that your body, you don't feel that you are enclosed in the small shell that we are in the perimeters of our body, but that we are in fact part of a broader community, we are part of a much broader body. It's only when you have that, in a way, when you have the sense of continuity with others and connection with others, that you also overcome so many fears and anxieties, including the fear of dying, including the fear of the end of your own personal story, because you feel part of something much broader. But we have gone into a long, long way. We are in a long, long way to losing that, you know, to losing that connection. And it's a very much part, I believe, added to our separation from the natural world, is a great part of the sense of unhappiness, of the sense of anxiety, of the sense of estrangement that I think so many of us today feel, you know, in this world. And it's certainly part of the journey that we need to travel in the opposite direction. And in this way, I also want to add here something about that walking here and talking to Alex brought to my mind the question of historical memory. You know, one way of being disconnected from other people and from this broader collective story and body, it's also to lose our historical memory. And again, so much investment, you know, has been made in destroying that memory. And that's why, in my view, connecting with the past, returning to the past as we look to the future, is extremely important. You know, you place yourself in a much broader history, and you begin to see the continuity of what you've done. Not only you learn from the experience of people who came before you, but you also find yourself part of something much larger, right? That it's a tremendous source of strength, I believe, you know, in our life. So this is where I think these are all this question of the powers that we have lost, and you know, the path that we need to walk in order to reclaim or to reconstruct some of this power, is an extremely important moment of our political work. However, for our political work you know, to be able to actually engage in the process of reconstruction, right? It is also important that we do not engage in political work as if it were another form of alienated labor. And I think that this is now something that is becoming part of a collective discourse. I think that more and more, as we are reflecting on why political movements often, you know, as I said, surge and then dissipate, right? We're beginning to realize certain rules of political change, certain rules of political activity that are extremely important. And two that I want to basically mention tonight that I'm sure are all common sense. Is first of all, the renunciation, you know, of the idea of political work as a form of sacrifice that we make, you know, to some cause, and that is continuously postponed and postponed, you know, its realization is continuously postponed in time. And that's why I spoke about alienated work. You have alienated work when basically you subordinate, you know, your own desire, your own need, your own energies to the realization of a goal that is outside of you, that is not connected, you know, with your own need, with your own desire, with your own creativity, with the activity that you need in order to grow, to shape who you are, or to transform yourself. And this is what much of political work has traditionally been, you know, when the objective is posed, you know, outside of your day-to-day, you know, when the reaching of the objective is seen as something separate from the process of your own daily reproduction. And this is, the, in a sense, the quickest road to alienation, burnout, dissociation, and, in a sense, destruction of a movement. And the second pitfall, and very connected with the first, is when you begin to again separate political work from the day-to-day work of reproduction, right? And that's why we, you know, have been speaking about the notion of a self-reproducing movement, right? When in a certain way, you know, political work again, it's one thing, and the reproduction of everyday life, you know, is seen as belonging to a different sphere, right? A process that has many, many implications. One being, of course, that, you know, you sacrifice your own well-being, sacrifice of your own well-being, sacrifice of your own desire is seen as almost indispensable. To reach your political objective, but has other implications as well. Because when you enter into that logic, when you apply that kind of logic to your political work, right, you also almost inevitably begin to exclude from political activity, begin to exclude from the movement, right, a whole range of people, a whole range of comrades, brothers and sisters, right, who are not, because of the situation with their life, illnesses, pains, traumas, losses, are not able to adopt the kind of regime that those in the presumably the movement requires in order to reach its objectives. Many of the, you know, comrades who have come together to begin this discussion about how do we create communities of care. And I'm talking about New York, but it's not only New York. Have really been motivated precisely by the kind of experiences that I'm talking about. Many were younger people, very young people, 20, 21, many with very serious diseases. Many who have gone through particular traumas in their life, from childhood or later, who because of it felt that increasingly they were being excluded by the movement because they could not keep up with the kind of expectations, with the kind of discipline that the movement imposed on them, that increasingly, despite the signs and declaration of support, they were being left behind. And here I want to mention how important has been the experience of ACT UP. Maybe a number of you were connected with it, to begin to create a different type of thinking, right, as to what it means to do political work and how we need to really not separate the process of production, of reproduction, of our life from the process of trying to reach certain political forms of organizing and objectives. Because actually ACT UP performs something quite unique that I think has been educational for many people in the movement. If you remember, I don't know, I see some people of my generation, but most of you are younger than me, much younger. And so you probably don't remember that in the Reagan period, at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, right, AIDS was supposed to be the demise, the end of the gay movement, right? It was supposed to show the way it was being used and talked about, to show once and for all that gay people lead a kind of life that leads to disease and to death. Well, actually, ACT UP was able to turn that discourse around and transform a disease that was supposed to be an instrument of defeat of the movement into something of a moral victory in the end, because it was able to activate, as part of its political work, such a support network, such a reproductive network on so many levels, in terms of creating alternative research channels, in terms of creating support networks, people visiting those who were diseased, in terms of contacting doctors, etc., etc. So it's that model that has been inspirational, and to many people who now feel that we need to rethink what it means to do political work, right? And we cannot do political work unless, at the same time, as part of it, we also begin to provide, right? To take into account the very basic reproductive needs that we have individually, collectively, in our communities. And in a sense, I don't know how many of you here tonight are involved in the anarchist movement, but the whole notion of mutual aid, right? Rethinking forms of mutual aid. But I think this has come back in the discussion that has taken place, but I think that we need to go beyond the notion of mutual aid. I think the mutual aid was a way to, for people in working class community to give support to each other, to be able to get through, to be able to, survive in face of great misery, in the face of great attacks from employer. But certainly I think that we need to go beyond, and we need instead to think of ways in which we can begin to recollectivize, our process of reproduction. That we need to rethink, our reproduction at all levels, in a different ways, in a way that reconnects, I think, what the history of capitalism has separated. I'm going to stop here because I really want to hear from you. I really want to have a dialogue with you on these matters. And I hope you'll have many questions and comments and criticism, and so we can learn together. Thank you.
And just before we do questions, there's a couple of quick announcements. First, we want to say a big thank you to Studio 34 and especially to Morgan for hosting us. And also special to Sarah, Joe, and Alex for organizing this, and to Sylvia for coming. And then, secondly, you're all invited to the Knot Squad after this for dessert. If you want to keep, have more questions, more things to talk about after question and answer, and the address of 4821 Baltimore. And then the third thing is, Sylvia wasn't brought here by a university or isn't getting an honorary to come eat here and speak with us at these two events. And so, like I've done at other events before, that maybe you guys know, I'm going to pass my hat around, and we're just asking if people have a few dollars to throw in to support autonomous, feminist, anti-capitalist education. That would be great.
So, yes. Yeah, I think, for instance, that one of the pleasures that many people have rediscovered through urban farming, the urban gardens, has been precisely that double process of reconnecting with nature, the fact of seeing something grow, right? The sense of the very simple power that we have of interacting with nature in a way that we can actually make something grow, right? Which is a very healing power. It's discovering a magic, that our body can perform, that our work can perform, right? To plant something in the soil and see that something useful is generated, and something beautiful is generated. And to see that we can actually communicate with the earth, right? And that's a tremendous power that we have lost. I always make the example of the population of this continent, particularly South America, right? That were geniuses, were magicians from that point of view. And they fed the world. 200 species of potatoes, right? 200 species or more of corn, right? They study a place like Machu Picchu, for instance, where they were so attuned to the natural environment that they were able to produce all these varieties because they adapted the seeds in the selection of seeds. They adapted it to different degrees of shades, different degrees of exposure to humidity, of exposure to the wind. Imagine to have a body that is so sensitive and so attuned, right, to that natural environment. The garden have begun to bring back that experience to some urban people, and together with that experience also that experience of collective, right, of collective farming, of exchanging, which is something that we do not have. We work collectively in the work process, but we work, under the guideline, under the rule, of objectives that are imposed on us, so that creative process of sharing, inventing, experimenting. That creativity in our activity is something that we most of the time lack, except in the struggle. And that's why it's such a disaster when the struggle too becomes alienated labor. It's something that you go, the meeting that you go because you have to go, right? The one more flyer that you have to write that you really don't want to write, and you become, and that's the worst. That's the worst. That should be a principle that never, when you want to cry rather than to go into a meeting, don't go to a meeting, go to a movie. Because that's the worst thing that you can do on yourself. The worst thing to be alienated in the very process is supposed to liberate you. Right? Because that logic that you apply to your life that destroys your life, that makes you leave a movement, is also the logic that then you apply to other people in the expectation that you have of them. And in that sense, there is a whole, you know, weaving defeat that begins to percolate, right? I'm not sure if I... Yes.
I heard you kind of saying that the sort of, like, different economic conditions in different time periods produce, like, a sort of state of mind or mentality, and we have, like, this... In our period, there's this socialization, this very extreme aggressive individualism.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to know, like, if the process of recollectivization, if that would be a flat out kind of like denial or rejection of that sort of modern individual, or would it be more of a synthesis of like these more historical notions of collectivity, but also incorporating some of the things we value as being individuals,
mm-hmm.
since we see
yeah.
the world through that lens
constantly. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure that I'm... as I said, I don't think that when we speak of recollectivizing, right? And I think the word collectivizing, reproduction, I use it a lot, but always with a touch of unease, right? Because the notion of collectivizing had so many Stalinist vibrations that I'm really looking for better words. Right? So, you know, in the early phase of the Russian Revolution, there was exactly that type of attempt to collectivize reproduction. And there were some very futuristic architects who imagine, you know, the barrack. So you have the factory, and then you have the factory producing workers, you know, where you have your place, but everything is collective. You eat collectively, et cetera, et cetera. And in a way, that's not the ideal, because, again, it's, yes, it's the shaping of that collectivization. It's still subordinate with the idea that reproducing life, that the well-being individual is not the highest goal, that the highest goal is the process of industrialization, is productivity, the productivity of labor, that these are the goals, and that reproduction is subordinated to them, right? So I think we need a process of invention, experimentation, that we have to begin to apply now in our work to understand how we can integrate, how we can reconcile the different needs, the needs of being together and at the same time alone when we need to, right? And I don't think that there are models in the past. The past is important. It's an inspiration, but in a way we have to reinvent the present. And I would say, you know, that there is a lot of work that needs to be done. Today there's a big discussion about commons, right? The commons has become like a mantra. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in the fact that there are different models among people. When people speak of commons, everybody now speaks of commons, including the World Bank. Global commons, and that's a big danger. So we have to be very careful when we speak of commons, right? But I see that people speak of commons as electronic commons. So some people, for them, the commons is the internet, right? It's the big common now. other people have in mind natural resources, land, forests, particularly when I think of, the struggle of women in Asia, Africa, Latin America, commons there, people like Vandana Shiva, you know, Earth Democracy that Alex was reading on his shelf. These are the commons that come to mind, are the forests, are the commons that are now being destroyed by agribusiness and so forth. But there's another common that is never talked about, and I'm very interested in, and it's the reproductive commons. It's the commons not only reproductive from the point of view of land, from the point of view of forest and waters, but it's the common of the home. You know, how we tear down the walls of the home. How do we create a different way of reproduction that does not have the walls, right? Does not enclose us, separates us, you know, from the neighborhood, you know, from other people, but, you know, we have the possibility of a form of reproduction that is much more fluid, that doesn't turn into, you know, an atomized unit or even worse, a kind of a prison that, you know, historically have been the prison in which women have been enclosed, right? So I don't have a solution, but I have a desire for the experimentation. Yes.
Thank you so much for speaking. This is really inspiring. Thank you for coming here. A couple of quick things.
Sure.
One is, you mentioned ACT UP. I'm sure most people have already known this, but there is an ACT UP in Philadelphia, which is kicking ass, and meets on Monday nights at St. Luke's Church at 13th and Spruce. Is that right? Second, movement that spawned out of ACT UP to push for the end of AIDS, to push for a cure. There's a grassroots activist conference coming to Philadelphia, actually organized by Philadelphians at the end of May. Every person in this room is extremely welcome and desperately needed to join us.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you know anything about it or not, we need you. And the third thing was that and you just said that you were just talking about the need for experimentation, but I know that in ACT UP there was always and has still been a struggle between getting work done and attending to personal needs.
Mm-hmm.
And while there is this big thing where people would go to the hospital, I mean, it's slow
mm-hmm.
going.
Yes.
There's so many care aspects of it, but there was always a tension. And one thing that people did was they formed caucuses
mm-hmm.
that had preeminent power in the group. Like if you were in a caucus of people that was ill, you could stop meeting.
Well, I think along those lines, yes, that's why you need a large social movement to attend to the individual needs of people, because every time you enter in a situation of care of the type that ACT UP was involved in, or that the type that is necessary when you're attending to a person who is ill, right, or a person who is old and not able to be self-sufficient. You always need two types of care. One care for the person who is ill or not self-sufficient, and a care for the carer. Because the need, and this is very, very important, and I'm glad you raised that question, because it's an issue that only now, and mostly in some feminist circles, have begun to come to the forefront, because many women and also men are facing the fact that their parents are aging, they need to take care of their parents, and so that issue is becoming more important, but for a long time has been outside of any political organizing. You know, there hasn't been really any discussion of care work within political work, political movements, right? And in fact, we are experiencing an extreme crisis on that level, because we are experiencing the fact that hundreds of thousands of people, just speak of the United States, are not receiving by any stretch of imagination the care they need, and are living in conditions that are in some ways condition of a concentration camps. When you think of those who are in nursing homes, where they have a very limited personnel, often forced to stay in their beds, maybe in their urine, for hours and hours and hours, because not enough funds are devoted to their care, right? When we begin to look into the world, you realize that there is an immense need, and there is an immense suffering because of it. And you need a movement who is able, in fact, to deal, both with those who are in need of that care, and also, again, with those who provide it. I mean, these two cannot be separated. Otherwise, it's like with political work. The care will become the care for, become the one who gets sick, because you cannot sustain on a day-to-day basis, that type of work. But we also need to change completely our understanding of what care means, of what care work means, right? Because there's so much negativity attached to it now. I think that this is becoming more of a political issue. For example, that we associate care with a degraded state. If you are cared for, if you are ill, right, it is assumed that you cannot be an autonomous person. So autonomy, how do we think of autonomy? Right? You lose your autonomy because you're sick, because you may have cancer, because you may become paralyzed, or do we still, in a sense, are capable of seeing that a person who is dependent in a certain respect on others, it's also a person who has a lot to give. It's also a person who is autonomous. It's not a person who is to be looked down upon, right? That we need to overcome, I think, in order to have a political organizing that is effective. We need first to challenge the dominant ideology that basically says, you have to be self-reliant, you have to make all the provision in your life so you're not going to be dependent on other people, right? And this notion that somehow to need others to help you in certain respect, is something that degrades you, is something that society should not encourage, is something that other people, and in fact, so-called care work is one of the least valued work. If you look at the people who perform it and what they get, from society in compensation for their work, you see that it's one of the least value. So there's a tremendous amount of transvaluation of values to be performed in order to create a kind of structure that is really supportive, right? A changing how care work is seen, as well as how it is organized. Yes.
Just in direct response to that, I guess I'm wondering if you've been exposed to ADAPT or any other disability rights movement organizers, which are people living with disabilities fighting for their own rights and also talking a lot about personal care attendance and assistance. There's a number of pretty powerful movements, including a really huge one.
I'm very, very interested in it. I read everything I can. I've not been directly in contact with this organization. My experience of care work in my own personal life has been around, and a lot of things I've learned is through my own care of my mother. And so I experienced a lot about the care work organization and so on that were available when my mother was ill in Italy, but not here. But I've since been very interested in the question of care workers. Their organizing and the whole social construction of it, which is actually, there's been a growing attack on care work you know, the amount of state resources devoted to it has been continuously cut. For example, you have now aides, nurses who used to do home care, used to go to take care, provide meals, you know, clean up houses of people who are not self-sufficient. And now their time has been cut so much. I mean, this varies depending on the state and the town, but the time has been cut so much that most of them don't even have the time to have a little conversation with these persons that they are serving. You know, they have the time to drop the meals, they have the time maybe to do some quick housework, make the bed, but they can they cannot be in a human relationship with the people they are serving, even though they're probably desperately alone and needing that more than anything else, right? But I would love to hear about that. You know, I'd be really like, if you could, yeah.
Yeah, also building on that, I wanted to ask about the attack on care work as an attack on women, and
yeah.
particularly, you know, teachers, nurses, a lot of professions that are dominated by women. But then, like, a related question is that I've heard you write or speak about women having a special role to play in terms of creating a more caring society.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if you could say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it is an attack on women because, you know, it's historically women have been the care workers, right? And you know, to this day, it's most of the care work is done by women, which is not to say the men do not do care work, but to this day, the majority statistic across the world is women who do the care work, right? And you have now situation in the United States, also just to use the statistic from the U.S., where you have women who are in between, right, sandwiched between doing care work towards their children and at the same time doing care work towards their parents, and sometimes even trying to juggle having a job in between, right? And I see very clearly as part of the general devaluation of reproductive work, right? The reproductive work is to be strictly functional, to you know, production for the market, subordinate to it, and functional to, you know, making people capable of market-oriented work and cutting the cost of labor. And so that devaluation of reproductive work is also devaluation of those who have been the subject of this reproduction. I say that women are the ones who have, in a way, most to contribute to rethink the production world, because they have a long history of doing this work. If you do this work, there's a lot to learn. There's a lot to learn as to what people need, for instance. It's only by a long, you know, experience of being with a person who is sick that there's a whole, you know, and this interacts with the question of knowledge. Which kind of knowledges do we privilege? Which kind of knowledges do we recognize, right? And now we are all enthusiastic again about the computer. It's not that I want to attack computer, please. And I'm not against technology. It's also what kind of technology and what priorities we establish, right? And I would say that there's a whole knowledge that you learn when you are living and working with a person who is ill and so on, that not necessarily work you gain through the computer, right? And this is why, you know, I don't want to essentialize women, to claim that women are destined to care work. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying there's an historical experience, an experience that it's rooted in today's organization of work and today's knowledge that women, many women don't have an experience of that. But as the majority of women are the ones who are doing it or expected to do it. And in that way, I think they can make the best contribution. Yeah, you have a question?
Well, I have very profound differences with the current government of Israel. When you talk about caring community, it seems to me that seems to be a
Could you come a little closer, because I cannot hear you well.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was just saying that while I have profound differences with the current government of Israel, when you talk about caring communities, the early Kibbutzim movement seems to come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering whether you saw that as perhaps a viable model to look at.
You know, I really don't know enough to pronounce myself on that. I really prefer not to say, because I really don't know enough. I mean, I have a very general conception that I wouldn't be able to speak wisely to it.
Okay.
Yeah. You. Yeah.
Yeah. So, in the movements that you've been involved in, as far as, like, you know, using, like, your time and energy, like, most strategically, would you rather, like, work in a movement that, like, works on building relationships with people, or would you rather work on a movement regarding housing, or would you rather work on a movement, you know, changing specific laws? Like, which do you think is, like, a most effective sort of way to, like, spend your energy and expend your time, or even, like, creating more art or whatever, in your experience?
Yeah, well, when it seems to me all of the above. It seems to me that you cannot have one or the other. It seems to me that the question of building experience, relationship with people, catering to the needs that people have in the movement, as well as to the objective that you're pursuing, that is something that has to be part of every struggle. I don't see a movement who can really survive, sustain itself. It doesn't create that type of community, the type of collectivity, the type of relationship, right? But it seems to me that all the forms of struggle that you have mentioned are all important. I think each of us has to understand, you know, where there is an immense field of struggle, right? It's immense. And I think each of us has to understand where you can contribute best, you know, where you're most drawn to because of the experiences that you have. Right, we cannot just adopt a cause abstractly, right? But there are certain causes in which we can make a contribution because we do have an understanding, because we do have an experience to which we can speak to, right? Which doesn't mean that we have, you know, I don't want to give a sense of fixation, because our horizons expand and we move from struggle to struggle. But what I'm saying is that there is a broad range of struggles that are obviously important today. And the building of community and the broad national and international objectives are not separate. You know, they require each other. Mm-hmm. I think ideally, and I think that this is what is missing today, I see that everywhere, at least in the US, is precisely that connection between different struggles. Until we begin to really connect the different struggles, instead of, you know, housing here, and then we have a bit of anti-war movement here, and then there's something around the urban garden, unless the movement is capable of going beyond these enclosures and really beginning to develop, you know, ways in which the struggle can give power to each other, I don't think we are going to go anyplace. I think that this is the challenge. I'm not sure if I respond to your question.
Yeah, well, it doesn't make my life any easier.
No, it can. It can, because if you think you've got to do the whole, then it makes your life easier. Because it means that if you have that kind of connectivity, then you don't have to be present on every struggle that is out there to fight. It means that you begin to, reflecting from the struggle you are in, you begin to see what are the implications of the struggle you are in for this. What are the implications of your struggle around housing for schooling? What are the implications of your struggle about housing for daycare, etc., or for land in the neighborhood, right? So that starting from a particular experience in areas of struggle, you can actually move to a very vast world. But it doesn't mean that you have to, in a sense, take on the whole weight of the world on your shoulders. It means that you begin to you know, the deeper you become involved in a situation, the more connection you begin to see, and the more implication for the other struggle the people are moving. And the question is whether a movement has the power, instead of fighting among each other, as all too often is happening today, to actually build the connection so that a kind of circulation of information, practices, support can be built. This, I think, is what we need to do. Because enough of these great surges and then dissipation of energies. We don't have the state of the world is well, our own state. It's too much in crisis, you know, to ask, you know, the famous poem by Brecht, right? That, it's a beautiful poem. It's a story of, the Buddha. The Buddha is walking along his road and passes in front of a house on fire, right? He sees that the house, the roof is on fire, and inside everybody's partying and drinking. So he goes in and he says, "The house is on fire, the house is on fire, the roof is on fire." Right? And then people turn to him and they say, "How is the weather outside?" Right? And then he walks out and he says to people who in front of the fire ask, "How is the weather outside? I have nothing to say." Right? And I think we don't have, yes, we have to, it's to do the kind of experimentation that I'm saying we need, you know, and build those connections. Because I think our houses are on fire. You know? Yes. I don't know, maybe somebody else should keep track, because I also, with a bit of the lights, I'm not
there
sure.
There are a couple questions that were on
the side. Okay, one, two, yeah. They've gone. I've answered them. I didn't even know.
So, first, I want to say I'm an urban farmer, so I appreciate the affirmation. And as well, so oftentimes when I see it, that these self-care sort of choices that people are making often sort of reek of this privilege that comes with being able to build parallel institutions or parallel organizations. And so I'm curious, in your travels and in your lifetime, if you've seen examples of a way that it doesn't just facilitate more of a class division or something.
Care work of the...
Yeah.
Well, actually, I just came back from Bolivia. I was in La Paz for about 2 weeks, and I was host of a women's center that I was very, very impressed with, and so I want to talk about them a bit. The name of the group is called Mujeres Creando. Has anybody heard of them? Mujeres Creando, okay. Yeah, they're really great, right? Mm-hmm. And they have this house. I knew of them before, but I didn't know what they had actually created. They have been active since the early 80s, and they began, you know, under dictatorship, and really at the time when the country embarked into this very strict structural adjustment program that massive impoverishment and dislocation. So they began to organize. What they have today, I mean, it will take me the rest of the night to talk about what they're doing, because they're working at so many levels. But just to give you an idea, they have created this center, which is a very, very, very active with, they have a radio, they have a journal, they have a cheap restaurant where they provide everyday food to people, they sell it, they're self-sustained, they don't get money from the state, they don't get money from NGOs, they're definitely not involved in NGOs, they're very much hostile, I think with good reason, to NGOs. They have a daycare center. You know, originally they decided to set it up because they were concerned that so many women were prostitutes, their children, they had really no place, nobody to care for them. But then they expanded, so now the daycare is for a broader range of women. And the daycare, it's very interesting. It's an example of starting from one struggle, you move on, because they started with the daycare and then basically to help women to have more autonomy, not only to go to work, but to also have to have more autonomy, do political work, do all kinds of things, have a breathing space in their life, right? But then from the daycare, they had to raise the whole issue of education. What does it mean for a child, right? What does a child of 3, 4, 5, what is that they need? The relationship among the children, the question of sexuality. So they began to tackle, how do you teach issues of sexuality to children? Then they realized that if they had to teach sexuality to children, and what does it mean about your body, they had to talk with the mothers, right? They had to, so they started having meeting with the mothers, who many times for the first time, it was the first time that they talked about their sexual life and what sex means to them and how they see their relationship, the sexuality of their children. Then some fathers started saying, well, what about us? Why are you talking to our wife, but not to us? So actually now, these women who started around the daycare, right, have sprawled to all these new, and some of these have begun to go into the radio, which Mujeres Creando also have. So now they're talking about this question about, and then there is another activity is, helping women with learning about technology, learning about computer, learning about how to use the radio, because the radio is open, you know, to anybody, any woman or man who wants to come from the community, who has a good story to tell, who has a story of struggle or something important, useful to have. The radio is to everybody's disposal. They have an archive. What else they have? It's something that has grown, and that it's basically a connective tissues. You can really see that it's a big reproduction center, and it's a reproduction that it's also connecting people, connecting parts of people's life and communities. There's also a lot of other work that they have been doing, for example, to expose the scam that is microcredits, right? That is impoverished, instead of being instruments for lifting women out of poverty, has actually been an instrument of enslavement, because it's organized in such a way that sure enough, you're going to fall into debt. You know, and it's already led to, in fact, many women committing suicide, because once you fall into that, then the bank begins to persecute you. They paint your house so that everybody knows that you have defaulted. They put your name and picture on the public walls. And this, by the way, I discovered that is an international practice. You know, because the story of women committing suicide out of shame is a story that now has come from different sources, not only from Bolivia, but also from parts of Africa. This is what the banks now do, you know, when you are unable to. But that's another story. So this, to me, is a powerful example of how a group, right, can both, starting from the everyday life of people, can then also engage in a broader struggle. Because obviously, all of these issues that Mujeres Creando is organizing about continuously bring you in confrontation, negotiation with the authorities, with the government, with the question of how resources are being spent. You know, services that are provided or not provided, right? So you start from where people are, where the needs are, and in that sense, they are, you know, very. It's a very powerful work that they are doing. I've walked with them in the street, and people know them, even in a big city like La Paz. You know, many women will say, "Ah, yes, you know, I could see that there was a real relationship." you know, with people in the street. Yeah? You had your hand up?
I'm sorry.
No, I didn't.
What you said about not taking on the struggle as a personal sacrifice, which so much of us do resonates with me.
Mm-hmm.
It just sort of brings up for me what you say also about fighting against the individualized power of capital. And it just sort of strikes me that I think the reason that so many of us end up performing that sacrifice is out of trying to say no to that individualized power, trying to step into a world that is more collective, and by saying,
mm-hmm.
Give of myself into, you know, in hopes for something, a world that will be more.
Yes.
Bye. And in tying my, like, in doing this work, that's at least some connection to a world outside of myself that is denied, like, most of our existences, at least in our relationship with making money or doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really a question.
Yeah, but then I guess it's not sacrifice, you know. Sacrifice, it means when you give up something that is important to you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Sacrifice is, I know this, the world has brought historical resonances, positive and negative. And that's why I think we need to rethink that word. Because, you know, one principle I've adopted in my life and political work at all levels is that there is nothing I do to myself I don't do to others. You know, the kind of rules that you apply to your own life, you always end up applying it to others. So if you think of sacrificing your life, you're going to sacrifice the life of others. So we need to reflect, what do we mean when we say sacrifice? Because it's very true that in many ways, when we say, oh, I'm not going to go this career, you know, and instead I'll do the struggle and I'll be poor, but it may sound like sacrifice. But I would like to say that it's not. I would like to say, I wouldn't like to call it sacrifice, because there's a kind of bad association that I put to the word sacrifice, that it means that I'm taking away something vital from my life, something that I need, and then give it up and for the struggle. Whereas this, to me, the struggle is a healing process. If the struggle is not a healing process, we say our struggle, our healing. If the struggle itself is not a healing process, it's not worth it. There's something wrong with it. There is something wrong with it. Right? In a way, I think this is the only place you struggle because you need to liberate yourself. If the struggle does not liberate you, if the struggle is not a moment in the process of liberation, is that doesn't carry that hope. Why bother? That's my view. And that's why you might want to continue it, even if you're suffering. Doesn't mean that the struggle does not make you suffer, but suffer is not sacrifice. It's very different. There may be pain comes to it, but maybe it's a pain that is better than the pain you would have if you don't struggle. Maybe it's a pain that prevents you from dying, because we can die, you know, from numbness, from irrelevance, from wasting your life in triviality, from despair, from inertia, passivity, you know, from giving up whatever creativity you have in yourself. So sometimes it's worth suffering not to see that in yourself, right? But I wouldn't call that sacrifice.
It's a difficult juggle. I know.
I know. But in a way, you know, I really think that as a rule, you know, the struggle must be in itself a reward. Otherwise, you have to rethink it, you know, go back to the drawing board. Maybe I'm doing something wrong. you know, the famous story of going to the meeting. I've gone through a period in my life where one more meeting I would have cried, and I paid a price for it. The exit, the result was not that, you know, success because I had sacrificed and gone to the extra meeting. On the contrary, whenever I reached the stage, the results were dismal. And I've had my own dose of dismal results. Yes. Yes.
I just turned 28, and as I go from, you know, teenage activist to, you know, younger 20s activist, and I age more and more, I become more cognizant of the role that age plays in one's political life, and how increasingly it becomes more and more difficult to, as the commons disappears, it seems like the older.
Well, I don't know if it is a matter of age, right? I'm not sure it is a matter of age, because I think more it's a matter of stages and the physiology of the movement. I mean, the history of the movement that I think in many ways that collective experience, to use that term, that was so prominent, for example, in the 70s, has dissipated. It's there, that we still have organization and so forth, but that very intense sense of collectivity that, for good or for bad, certainly existed in the 70s, right? They've something that can be said about the movement, or all movement inside. They always exposed you to a you know, not only the communes, but continuous exchanges with other people. That is not there. And I don't think necessarily it's a question of age. I think it's a question of the forms of organizing that have, in a way, you know, separated, I think, about the 60s and 70s. Again, for all the limits and so on of those movements, neither the women's movement, nor the anti-war movement, not the student movement, in a way, separated. The question of transforming your life in one way or the other was always on the table. And people engage in a tremendous amount of experimentation about transforming their life, right? So even the question of communal living was a way of creating, for all the damages that at time it did and so on. But it was extremely creative movement in my experience, right? That, you know, my life was changed by it in a very profound way, because I was forced, everything was politicized. And I think it was very useful, you know, to think politically. What does it mean to share a house together, right? What does it mean to try to create an egalitarian relationship in the process of sweeping the floor every Saturday, or and so on, or sexuality, right? What does it mean to have good sexual relationships that are not exploitative, right? The question of reproduction. All these questions were politicized and were part of a collective discourse. I personally feel very bad for the women of the younger generation today who are not having that experience, and for men of our generation who are confronting all the same issues, right? What does it mean? For example, nobody talks any longer about sexuality. What happened? Right? It's only the gay movement who speaks about sexuality, the queer movement. Right? But outside of the queer movement, people do not speak. Sexuality has ceased to be, I'm certain, the women's movement. Right? People speak of income-generating activities. I'm talking about the NGOs, the so-called feminist NGOs. But there's a whole area of discourse about the so-called private life that has gone out of the, right? And I think that's a problem. You know, I think that's a problem. And that's why I think that many younger women are now beginning to rethink and revalue feminism, which they first rejected, you know, as something that was dead, bought off, institutionalized, with a lot of good criticism, right, in terms of what feminism has become. But I think that many of them have also begun to rethink, because they are now discovering in their own lives some of the same dynamics that we were confronting, right? And except that now they don't have that kind of, you know, broad networking and support structure and discussion where these issues of the private are, you know, very much seen as having political implications. So I would say, you know, create those kind of, you know, engage in that kind of debate, you know, because I don't think it's a matter of age. Actually, with my own age, in my own life, the more my life has become more collective in that way. So I don't think it's a matter of age. Yeah.
You've spoken of the importance of the organization of reproduction and care and sustaining the movement.
Yeah.
Obviously, a strong movement is very subversive of capitalist relations. But I was wondering if you could speak of other ways in which kind of radical experimentation or communalization of reproduction is subversive of kind of capitalist regime of relations and production as a whole.
Yeah. For example, self-reduction movements, collective self-reduction movement, where you have a whole community. But in order to do that, you have to have a cohesive community. To have where, for example, I'm thinking of Italy in the early 70s, right? There was a very, very powerful, for years, self-reduction movement that applied broadly at all kinds of levels, where you say, okay, we establish what we pay for rent, the just rent, which is what we can afford. We establish what we pay for electricity, right? We establish what we pay for transports, right? We decide what we can pay. And we organize the community, and we organize self-reduction committees in different parts of the town that are taking care of imposing transportation, you know, costs, imposing self-reduction electricity, services cost, et cetera, et cetera. But believe it or not, for a number of years, these communities, these committees did exist and worked. I mean, you know, there is a literature on that that I can, you know, introduce you to. But in order to have that, right, it would be fantastic to have that now. Right? But in order to have that, you really have to have a kind of work in the community that has become much more difficult, because when you had, for example, in the States, right, you went through the Northeast industrial town in the 60s or 50s, you had community that were very cohesive. Because everybody knew each other, everybody worked in this factory or that factory, people knew who you were, etc., etc. You know, in the last 20, 30 years, a lot of those social fabrics have been, you know, disintegrated And this is one of the problems we are confronting today, that the kind of restructuring of the organization of work has also undone a lot of the social fabric that sustained, that could have sustained that type of political struggle, right? And this is really one of the most fundamental obstacles today of recreating those networks, or maybe not those networks, but different type of networks that can sustain these very, you know, strong movements to basically, you know, reestablish different conditions of reproduction. Is that what you had in mind?
Yeah, I mean, okay. I guess I had in the back of my mind the kind of auto-reduction. I guess I was kind of wondering, like, and you touched on it, like, let's say Philadelphia 2011, or what's, there's obviously so much that's different from Italy early 70s.
Yes.
Capitalist relations persist in a different form, you know, like one called post-fortis or whatever, but, like, is there something... Are there new avenues of communalizing reproduction here and now, kind of after the collapse of, I don't know, the kind of autonomous organizations of the industrial working class?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of, like, did you have any thoughts on, like, kind of what that looks like, or kind of nascent forms of that are not just, I don't say this to kind of like diminish the importance of sustaining a movement, but not just about sustaining a movement, but might have more maybe like structural.
Yeah, well, impact. Look, over the last 4 years, certainly the issue of housing, right? I don't know about Philadelphia. Actually, I'm ashamed, but I don't know much about Philadelphia. I know a bit more about other towns. I know, for example, in Boston, right, City Lights has been a fairly successful movement, I mean, within limits, about, you know, helping a lot of homeless people who were losing their homes, to begin. And again, the house is such a center of so many struggles, right? The house is so fundamental, and the loss of the house, and as well as the difficulty of paying the rent, has affected so many people at such a basic level, right? That would be a place where people can come together.
It's like maybe also the squatters movement in New York.
The squatter movement, right.
Financial capital.
Yeah, well, in New York it's very difficult. You know, the kind of struggle, for example, they have take back the land in Miami. In New York, it's hundreds of times they have tried repossession, entering into a building. Right, picture the homeless in New York has had tremendous difficulties because it's not like, you know, taking over a small house, or, you know, the moment you enter into a building in New York, you have an army of cops who descend on you, right? The level of repression in New York has been so high, and the city is so police and so you know, regimented. That so it really depends on much of the situation, but certainly the struggle around housing, you know, it should be an important catalyst. In the same way as I see the struggle now around student debt, right, about school education, teaching, the closing down of the schools is a major attack on reproduction, right? It's a major attack on the ability of people to be producers of knowledge. It's you know, these to me are the broad, you know, struggle in which we all have to be involved, right? It's not as you know, within the parameter of what I was saying before, that we all have our own contribution, right? But certainly the issues and very basic pillars of the reproduction of our future, right? These are the home, the attack on the teaching and the public schools. Right, the indebtment that so many people, that is a form of slavery, is a tremendous discipline. as to what you can study, what you can do, what kind of job you're going to get or not to get, right? It's a way of really, you know, it's a very incredible disciplinary tool. Mm? Those to me are the struggles that should be fundamental to change. Yeah.
So yeah, I just want to point out it's 9:30, so
uh-huh.
We're going to take just one or two more questions.
Okay,
wrap
sure.
Up.
Yes.
Morgan in the back.
Morgan in the back, and then.
So I just want to touch on a few things that
sure.
Several people have touched on, and you touched on, which is about our collective memory as a movement. And
yeah.
Memory of many movements. And
yes.
On the shoulders. And also as individuals, how we tend to forget our own patterns, both as individuals and also as movements. Whenever I read about movements in the past or find out about movements, in this very neighborhood that we were standing on the shoulders of, like, all this stuff was left by these other movements that preceded us. We have a food co-op, and that's cool. We have a credit union, that's cool. You know, and then a few months ago, we had a discussion right here from the folks who set those things up that set all these other things in motion that we inherited from our very culture of having a consensus process, and that's sort of being a given, that we don't vote. We decide everything by consensus. And then you get these people up where you're sitting right now saying, yeah, we tried that, and it's not really the be-all, end-all. It doesn't always work. So I'm hearing you echo a lot of that. Like, oh, yeah, we used to have that, and we used to do this. And I'm not seeing that so much today. And so there's a lot of collective forgetting as movements, as a network of movements, as a history of movements. But we also do that as individuals, you know? I personally beat myself up over and over again by doing direct action and organizing and taking over abandoned buildings and all this stuff. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm killing myself with this. So I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to be an artist. And so then I became an activist artist and was doing all this activist arts and staying up all night, and the police didn't like my stuff and they threw it in the garbage and threw my friends in jail and I had a nervous breakdown. And, oh my gosh, so now I'm going to become a yoga teacher. So here I am at the yoga studio, and then I get a phone call from Sarah saying, hey, we want to bring this awesome person here to do this thing, and then here comes my former community back in the place where
uh-huh.
I work and teach, and it's really great to see those things coming back.
Yeah.
And what I want to hear about is, what are we remembering as a movement? What are you seeing today that's like, yeah, that, and you've learned from this, and you're totally moving forward and doing it right, and right on, guys.
Mm-hmm.
You're so much better than they were in the 60s.
Because
mm-hmm. My whole life I've heard, like, oh, you should have been around in the 60s. Like, people really knew what was up then. And kids, nice try. Like, you know? So, what's up?
Look, you know, you have to forgive me. You have to forgive me because I have a bit, you know, that's been fundamentally a lot of my story. But I'm not stuck in the 60s, you know, because actually a good part of my formation has been, you know, through the story of the anti-globalization movement. But what I see now, I that was not in the 60s. I think, for example, the anti-globalization movement was very, very powerful. And that brought questions to the movement, and I'm talking about the U.S. now, that did not exist at all in the 60s. For example, the issue of land did not exist. Today, land is an issue in the movement, not only because of the urban gardens, but because the experience of globalization, the loss of land, the loss of forests, the loss of fisheries, right? Everybody is aware of that. And the value of what that means. What does it mean when you lose control over food, right? What does it mean when you don't know if what you're eating kills you or nourishes you, right? This is a whole level of knowledge and organizing that did not exist in the 60s. And it's a level of knowledge and organizing that is also placing people, you know, in contact with others across the world, in a way that did not exist in the 60s. Okay, some people went to Vietnam, and that was very important. That kind of solidarity was unheard of, was an historic first. You know, the people from this country went and, you know, fraternized with the enemy. But I think that what the anti-globalization movement did, right, was something different, was something new, because was to show the continuity, right, about the, our exploitation here and the exploitation of other people across the world, right? The story of, you know, what's the story of the shirt on your back, and discovering how the loss of your job, you know, in Detroit or other places, you know, became the exploitation of people in China or in Vietnam, and et cetera, et cetera. So I think there is a whole level of discourse and political practice today that did not exist in the 60s. And I think it's very, very powerful and encouraging. I think that what the movement is now learning in the US is to periodically, basically give its wealth up to the state, you know, in the form of campaign for the election. I think that, you know, we have a continuous ritual of disaccumulation of knowledge and revolutionary potential every seven years, whatever it is, that we deliver to, you know, all these energies and possibilities that, for example, existed in the last years of the Bush government. And then now seems to have dissipated, right? But yes, definitely there'll be other experts as well. But I don't believe, I'm not saying that the 60s was all, by no means. And I agree also that the question of historical memory is extremely important. And I think that as you're doing things, you also should be your historians. It's very important to take seriously what we do. And not only do it, but also make sure that what we do is handed down. So that we have communication, you know, with those who come beyond us.
Which is why we're videotaping this.
Good.
Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you. Small question. Small question. Well, that's definitely a very important question, because, you know, the commons, right, historically have not necessarily been egalitarian structures, right? Whether it was in the Middle Age or if it was in Africa, they are not in Africa today. So when we talk about building commons, it is very important that in that process of cooperation, we also place at the center of that the awareness that, you know, to communalize is not necessarily to establish a egalitarian relation. And therefore, what are the kind of rules that we need to apply to the construction of commons, whatever they are, whether it is the internet or whether it is, you know, natural commons or what other people call civic commons, right? So that is an integral part, the question of egalitarian foundation for them. That's the best I can say, without. Thank you.
Sylvia, and thank you all for coming. I just wanted to invite you all, for those who are interested, we're going to have a dessert fundraiser now at my house, 4821 Baltimore, just up the street. If you'd like to come, you're all welcome to talk more with Sylvia and to continue the conversation and have some vegan and non-vegan desserts. Please join us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Wonderful, Sylvia.